$2 on the bill. His tactic, in Johnson's words, to run it over into January, to piddle along and get it into February, was already underway. If civil rights wasn't moving through the congressional roadblocks before Christmas, the chances of its passing in July were slim. And it wasn't moving. Making other calls that weekend, Johnson checked up on the most recent attempts to accelerate the tax bill's progress through the Finance Committee. They hadn't succeeded. If we don't have Harry Byrd, there was little hope of their succeeding, as Smathers told him on Saturday, November 30th. We'd need Harry Byrd. They didn't have Harry Byrd. The South was using the strategy that had worked for years, and it was working again. To get the tax bill marked up, it would be a miracle, Smathers said. Smathers was talking about a markup before Christmas, but an equally unequivocal statement about the Finance Committee situation made some years later by the committee's ranking majority member, second in power to Byrd, Russell Long of Louisiana, dealt with a longer time frame. I couldn't move the bill out of committee, Long said. He, Byrd, wasn't going to permit the bill to pass. Go around Harry Byrd? Nobody was going to go around Harry Byrd. Even some of Kennedy's people had finally gotten the idea. It was stalled. The tax cut was stalled when Lyndon Johnson became president, Kennedy Budget Director Kermit Gordon was to say. Stalled completely, says Russell Long, the committee member with whom Kennedy's aides were working closely. The two Virginians, Byrd and Judge Smith, backed by the power of the Southern Caucus and directed by a master legislative strategist, had been thwarting presidents almost, it seems, since time began, Richard Revere wrote that November. It seemed clear that they would be able to do it again. One senator did not share those feelings. Smarter than they are, though Richard Russell may have been, smarter than his opponents in the Senate, it was not other senators who were Russell's real opponent now, but the new president, and Russell felt that fact would change everything. The Kennedy bills would be passed now, Russell told a friend. He'll pass them, whereas Kennedy would never have passed them. Lyndon Johnson, Russell felt, would even pass the bill against which Russell had been fighting and winning for 30 years. Discussing agricultural appropriations with Orville Freeman a few days after the assassination, Russell changed the subject and began talking about Lyndon Johnson. He said that Lyndon Johnson was the most amazingly resourceful fellow, that he was a man who really understood power and how to use it, Freeman recalls. And then, Freeman recalls, Russell said, "That man will twist your arm off at the shoulder and beat your head in with it." "You know," Russell said, "we could have beaten John Kennedy on civil rights, but not Lyndon Johnson." There was a pause. A man was perhaps contemplating the end of a way of life he cherished. He was perhaps contemplating the fact that he had played a large role, perhaps the largest role, in raising to power the man who was going to end that way of life. But when, a moment later, Richard Russell spoke again, it was only to repeat the remark. "We could have beaten Kennedy on civil rights, but we can't beat Lyndon." Chapter 19. Old Harry. Short and slight, 76-year-old Harry Flood Byrd walked softly, in recent years as he grew older, in scuffed crepe-soled shoes and often with a cane, with a pigeon-toed mincing gait, and talked softly, in a voice so whispery that his speeches could barely be heard in the high-ceilinged Senate chamber in which he had sat for 3 decades. His manner, unvaryingly formal, with a graciousness that a friend described as almost archaically elaborate, was mild and diffident, almost meek. His face, round, remarkably boyish and very ruddy, since he owned the world's largest privately held apple orchards, generations of journalists had been unable to resist describing him as an apple-cheeked apple grower, almost always bore a small but pleasant and friendly smile, and above the red cheeks shone a pair of blue eyes so bright they were continually being described as twinkling. It might have been the face of a benevolent, if aging, cherub, if behind those twinkling eyes there had not been hatreds, hatreds so intense that sometimes they broke through the courtly facade. Once, unable to restrain his rage when he saw NAACP President Roy Wilkins and lobbyist Clarence Mitchell, Both black men, sitting in the gallery, he shook his fist at them, and in a voice quite loud enough to be heard throughout the chamber, insulted them by likening them to Goldie and Dusty, the fictitious black twins whose ignorance and laziness enlivened a weekly radio comedy, shouting, "There they are, the Gold Dust twins!" His other hatred, an abhorrence of deficits, of big government and big government spending, was scarcely less intense. A biographer wrote of his extreme obsessive hatred of debt, his dogged fixation on economy. Looking over the dollar numbers attached to some proposed new government program, he would jab his fingers into the offending figures. His voice would generally remain soft and courtly at such moments, but the red face would grow redder still. It might have been the face of an aging cherub had it not been for the way Harry Byrd, the man his Senate colleagues fondly called Old Harry or Old Man Harry, wielded power in the two domains over which he ruled, his state and the Senate Finance Committee. The name Byrd has been written across all the pages of Virginia's history, since William Byrd I sailed up the James River in 1674 to found what became, with the help of generations of slaves, a vast tobacco plantation, one chronicler wrote. Among the other Byrds in the 14 generations that followed were a captain in George Washington's army, a colonel in Robert E. Lee's, and a speaker of the Virginia General Assembly. As Richard Russell was a Russell of the Russells of Georgia, Harry Byrd was a Byrd of the Byrds of Virginia. And since becoming governor in 1926, he had written his own pages in that history, with a statewide political machine known simply as the Organization. "The Byrd machine is genteel," the Liberal Reporter magazine had to admit. "There are no gallows-snapping or banjo-playing characters in Virginia politics." Its hallmark was courtliness, not the demagoguery prevalent in other southern states. "Virginia breeds no Huey Longs or Talmadges," John Gunther wrote in Inside USA. "The Byrd machine is the most urbane and genteel dictatorship in America." But a dictatorship it was. Candidates for office, almost any office, from state legislator down to local school board trustee, would, if the senator approved of them, receive an endorsement known as the nod. Without the Byrd nod, it was all but impossible to win an election in Virginia. The state's last nine governors had all received the nod, as had, of course, Howard Smith of the House Rules Committee. And candidates who tried to win without it encountered tactics that had earned the organization a different nickname, the steamroller. The Organization, or steamroller, runs the Commonwealth as effectively as Prendergast ever ran Kansas City, though with much less noise, Gunther observed. Because of its control over practically every office, no matter how minor, it is quite possibly the single most powerful machine surviving in the whole United States. Gunther had written that in 1947. Times might change, had changed in some respects since 1947. Virginia's demographic makeup had become dramatically more urban and African-American as the District of Columbia's suburbs spread into the state. But in 1963, the Organization, unchanged, was as powerful as ever. Voting by the newcomers hadn't altered the pattern of politics in the state because, in general, the newcomers couldn't vote. Virginia's efficiency, Byrd's efficiency, in the use of the poll tax to restrict voting by the black people he hated, was a model for the tactic. In the state's last gubernatorial election in 1961, only 17% of Virginia's voting-age population had cast ballots. A very wealthy man, Harry Byrd lived in a colonnaded mansion, Rosemont, that, as one writer admiringly put it, surmounts the nearby town of Berryville like a manor house over an English village, like the seat of an all-powerful country squire. And that was still, well into his fourth decade of power, the way Harry Byrd, courtly, gracious, mild-mannered, towered over Virginia politics. The apparent invincibility of the Organization makes it seem useless for the dissatisfied to oppose it, the reporter said. In his committee, Senate Finance, as it was known on Capitol Hill, the same was true. No chairman could have been more considerate, more polite to the committee members. Members were given all the time they required to be heard in committee sessions. These were senators, old Harry would say. They shouldn't be cut off. The sincerity of his beliefs, combined with the courtesy with which he fought for them, won him the respect and indeed affection of opponents, even of Paul Douglas, not only a fervent liberal, the most liberal member of Byrd's committee, but an economist by training, the author of influential books espousing liberal economic policy. "He hated public debt with a holy passion," Douglas was to write of Byrd. "With little or no sympathy for poor people and instinctively on the side of the rich and powerful, of whom he was one, he nevertheless had a certain rugged personal honesty and a genial air of courtesy toward his opponents, except when severely pressed. I developed a real respect for him." While he ran the committee graciously, however, he ran it unyieldingly. He had a habit of slapping a fellow senator on the back and laughing as if they were both enjoying a good joke while he was denying a request, recalls the Republican committee member Norris Cotton of New Hampshire. And he did it when Cotton asked him for a hearing on a bill he had introduced. "He continued to pat me on the shoulder and to laugh, but he said, 'Sorry, boy, you can't have a hearing on it.'" Cotton repeated the request several times, saying it would be embarrassing for him to have to tell constituents he couldn't get even a hearing, but Byrd simply repeated the refusal each time. Then, with a hearty final laugh and slap on the back, he ushered me out. His economic philosophy was a businessman's philosophy. No one ever called him a reader or a particularly deep thinker, or even a man with more than a surface understanding of the field, the fiscal and tax policy of the United States, in which Senate finance played so significant a role. He was, he often said, blind to charts, on which economists rely so heavily. He couldn't understand them, he said. As a member of his committee was to recall, he said if you wanted to convince him, you had to present it so he could understand it, and he could understand a column of figures. The figure that was important to him was the bottom line, the one that showed a profit, or in the case of government, a surplus, not a deficit. The deceptively apple-cheeked apple grower had a frank pleasure in the arts of business, the Saturday Evening Post noted. Government, he believed, must be run like one, with debt kept to a minimum, and the federal budget as firmly balanced as the ledgers of a successful corporation. And if Harry Byrd's story was a businessman's story, it was the story of a very tough and very shrewd businessman. In 1902, his father, having lost what remained of the Byrd money, all but bankrupt and about to lose the local newspaper that was the last thing he owned, agreed to turn it over to 15-year-old Harry, who dropped out of school. He was to have no further formal education. He struggled desperately for 10 years to make the newspaper succeed under the load of debt that had been placed on it. Since its credit had been cut off, he had to raise $6 a day in nickels, dimes, and quarters to pay, cash on delivery, for the newsprint on which the next day's paper would be printed. "When you have to hunt for them that way, you get to know how many cents there really are in a dollar," he was to say. With the newspaper at last in the black, he turned to apples, first spraying orchards, then leasing them, saving every penny so he could begin buying them, working endless hours year after year, until his orchards, which produced 1 million bushels a year, stretched for miles across the Shenandoah Valley. Only then did he go into politics, running for governor. Feeling, as a friend wrote, that debt had robbed him of his youth and education, the characteristic that distinguished him above anything else was that extreme obsessive hatred of debt, his fixation on frugality. The words he used on the subject had an almost religious intensity. "Improvident political promises and programs are sinful," he said once. "They are perpetrated on innocent citizens by demagogues." He said that the American dollar is the only thing today that is holding the world together. And once the American dollar goes down, we will go into an age of international darkness. The role he could play in defending economy and government, in balancing the budget, was, to him, another friend said, almost a sacred duty. He would have no truck with Keynesian theories, recalls Douglas Dillon, who, as Secretary of the Treasury, dealt with the senator more frequently than any other member of the Kennedy administration. Franklin Roosevelt had been all right for a while, Byrd was to say. The two governors had become personal friends. He had been an early supporter, the finance chairman, in fact, for FDR's first presidential campaign. Then this fellow Keynes got a hold of him. He liked to boast that, "I'm the only man left in the Senate who voted against the Wagner Act and the TVA." When President Kennedy, arguing that tax cuts would stimulate the economy and that the concept of a balanced budget was an outdated and misleading mythology, called in one of his typically eloquent speeches for new words, new phrases in economic theory, Byrd had been moved to make a speech of his own, in the old words and phrases. The illusions, he said, were the ideas that budgets did not have to be balanced, that debt was not evil. No one who witnessed his frustration and genuine indignation at government's indifference to the old verities could doubt their depth. Jabbing his finger one day in 1962 at a sheet of statistics on his desk, he said, "The civilian employment in government went up 35,000 in just the last month." The red face turned redder with anger. Again and again the finger jabbed the paper. "Just think of that. 35,000 in the last month." Believing that the size and cost of government should be reduced, that new government programs might be a menace to the American dollar, Byrd, Russell Long says, measured his success as a senator not by what he passed, but what he stopped from passing. And at the moment, when the issue before the Finance Committee was the Kennedy tax bill, he was being quite successful. His use of his powers as chairman, the virtually limitless powers of a chairman of one of the Senate's 15 great standing committees, powers that, as was explained in the last volume, were almost never overruled, was of course not confrontational. Senator Byrd was a gentleman of the old school, essentially a country gentleman, Dillon says, always most courteous in his relations with me and others. When, back in February and March, Kennedy had asked the senator to begin Finance Committee hearings on the tax bill without waiting for the House to pass the measure, all he had done was to explain that doing that would violate Senate procedure. "The old man won't begin hearings on the bill until it's sent over from the House," one senator said. "He's a stickler on this. Of course, one of the reasons for this is that he's opposed to doing anything anyway." When, in October, the hearings finally began, they moved very slowly, of course. Testimony thus far, in the hearing's sixth week, had all been on general topics. The committee had not yet taken up any of the individual amendments submitted by committee members. There were going to be quite a few individual amendments. The chairman had let it be known that members could submit as many of these special provisions important to them as they wished. 30 had been submitted already, and more were coming all the time. And the chairman had let it be known that he understood how important these special provisions were to their sponsors, and that members would be allowed ample time to discuss them. On some days, there were no hearings. He couldn't get a quorum, he said. To objections that finance was hearing the same witnesses and the same testimony that the House had heard for months on end, Byrd said that senators had to have the opportunity to hear these views for themselves, had to be able to question witnesses themselves, had to have all the time they needed to express their own views on the testimony. He wouldn't even consider cutting off a United States senator. In dealing with the president's men and with the president himself, he was unfailingly courteous, responding to each suggestion for speeding up the committee's work with some new technical reason why it couldn't be speeded up, and unfailingly impossible to pin down. Doodling on a pad during one discussion, Kennedy had written, "Pillow fight in the dark with Harry Byrd." Some of the Kennedy team did not seem to grasp the reality of what was happening. While describing Byrd's control of his committee as absolute, nothing could be done that he, Byrd, opposed. Dillon also says that although Byrd did not work actively to pass the Kennedy tax reduction bills, he did not oppose them, a statement that indicates the same lack of understanding of Byrd's tactics as the Treasury Secretary had displayed about Byrd's mild suggestion that he would like to see the budget come in under $100 billion. He did not oppose them. That was true. All he was doing was delaying them. "A sweet, dear guy, loved him," says the more realistic Russell Long, "but if he didn't want something to happen, it usually didn't, and vice versa. Bills didn't move until he decided they would move." No challenge from within the 17-member committee could threaten him. The Democratic Steering Committee, which appointed Democratic senators to committees, was dominated by Southerners, and made sure that there was always a comfortable majority among his party's members of finance, of whose support Byrd could be certain. On the Republican side, the ranking member was Delaware's Williams, a close personal friend of Byrd, and a fellow rock-hard fiscal conservative. And in general, all seven Republican committee members were conservatives and behind the chairman. In 1963, in the event of a challenge to his authority, Byrd could count on the seven Republican votes and, on the Democratic side, in addition to his own vote, five of the nine other Democrats. In all, a comfortable majority indeed. And, of course, behind him also was the interlocking power of the Southern chairman and of the chairman who stood with the South. Seldom was that power, and its consequences for a senator who opposed a chairman, expressed as bluntly as it was on one occasion to Illinois' Douglas, who was opposing pork barrel spending bills in several committees. He was informed that unless he stopped, he would find all public works projects for Illinois removed from bills before Hayden's Appropriations Committee. Bluntness was not usually required, however. A senator who opposed Harry Byrd would simply find that a bill he had introduced, perhaps a bill he urgently needed to satisfy constituents without whose support he could not be reelected, that was before Richard Russell's Armed Services Committee, or A. Willis Robertson's Banking Committee, or John McClellan's Government Operations Committee, or James Eastland's Judiciary Committee, or Alan Ellender's Agricultural Committee, or Lister Hill's Labor Committee, was simply not moving ahead within the committee process. He would eventually get the idea. Four finance Democrats, Douglas, Gore, Hartke, and Ribicoff, generally opposed Byrd, but they were four among 17. And no challenge from outside the committee could threaten them either. Three presidents had tried a challenge, each apparently believing that since Byrd's philosophy was so out of touch with that of the country at large, he was vulnerable, and that a president could exploit that vulnerability. After Byrd had broken with him before the 1934 election, Roosevelt began funneling federal patronage through Byrd's political foes in Virginia. Byrd won re-election by 40,000 votes, and when Roosevelt tried another tactic, nominating a federal judge unacceptable to Byrd and to Virginia's other senator, Carter Glass, the vote against the nomination in the Senate was 72-9, the most one-sided vote in Senate history against a presidential nominee. Truman's attacks on him in 1952, Byrd said, had actually helped me get reelected. Kennedy had tried a different route, trying to go around Byrd by creating an alliance with Robert Kerr, then the Finance Committee's ranking Democratic member and a Senate power himself, as part of which Kerr would have taken de facto control of the committee. While some members of the Washington Press Corps thought that the threat to Byrd's power was real, it never came even close to a showdown. Kerr, as Dylan noted, always recognized the position of the chairman and worked with his approval and never against him before Kerr's death in January 1963. Out of step with majority opinion in America, though Byrd's philosophy may have been, it was what the residents of his state, or at least those residents who managed to vote, wanted. Every presidential attempt to challenge his power in Virginia had only strengthened that power. Harry Byrd's Finance Committee was a feudal barony within the governmental system of the United States. He was one of the mighty chairmen who ran their committees as independent fiefdoms, and who were, in effect, although it was never written about in those terms, in alliance against the president, an alliance, now a quarter of a century old, that no president had been able to break. 2 days before Kennedy had left for Texas, the Washington Post's longtime Capitol Hill correspondent, Chalmers Roberts, had written that probably Byrd has never been more powerful than he is today. Right now he is all-powerful. Go around Harry Byrd, as the Kennedy legislative aides kept so blithely suggesting? Smathers wasn't the only senator who understood the impracticality of that suggestion. Johnson men, of course, had learned the lesson from Johnson. You couldn't go around Harry Byrd, Horace Busby says. During his years in the Senate, Lyndon Johnson had spent a lot of time reading Harry Byrd. At first, The book had been closed to him. During the first three of his Senate years, Byrd's attitude toward him had been so reserved that it sometimes seemed to border on dislike. Johnson had, nonetheless, never stopped trying to open the book, hadn't stopped doing everything to open it. Early in 1952, as was related in the last volume, Byrd's beloved 35-year-old daughter, Westwood, died after a fall from her horse during a fox hunt. Rosemont was a 2-hour drive from Washington, and heavy rain was falling on the day of the funeral. No other senators were planning to attend the services, but Johnson did, managing at the last minute to persuade another young senator, Warren Magnuson, to accompany him so he wouldn't be alone. And, Johnson told Busby later that day, as he and Magnuson stood in the rain across the grave from the Byrd family, holding their hats in their hands, the only senators present, Byrd suddenly looked up and saw them. "He looked at us, and then he looked back at me," Johnson told Busby. "I don't know what that look meant, but I'll bet it was a very important look." It was. Byrd's administrative aide, John Jake Carlton, told Johnson that he was welcome to drop around to Byrd's office when he had a problem he wanted to discuss. And Johnson used the privilege he had been given to make the impression he wanted to make on the courtly Virginian. He would always telephone ahead to Carlton for an appointment. But when he arrived at the office, even if Carlton said the senator was free and was expecting him and he could go right in, he wouldn't do so. Wouldn't walk right in even if I motioned to him that he could. Instead, to emphasize that he wouldn't even think of barging in, he would wait until I got up and opened the door, so the senator, Byrd, would know that he was going in only after I had opened the door. And once Johnson had the text open in his hands, he grasped and made use of the meanings he found within it. While Byrd's patrician aloofness made him unwilling to stoop to asking other senators how they were planning to vote, for example, he was nonetheless anxious to know what the vote would be on one of the tax or budget proposals about which he cared so deeply. After Johnson realized this, Byrd began getting this information without having to ask. Johnson, it was observed, counted for him, having Bobby Baker do the asking and then relaying Baker's findings to Byrd. Always offhandedly, casually, as if he didn't know how anxious Byrd was. Then, as the years passed, the text grew easier to read, and it became easier for Johnson to make use of what he read, because Byrd, after all, was already 67 years old when Johnson became majority leader. After her conversations with Johnson, Doris Kearns Goodwin was to write that he recognized that the older men in the Senate were often troubled by a half-conscious sense that their performance was deteriorating with age. "Now they feared humiliation," Johnson told her. "They craved attention. And when they found it, it was like a spring in the desert. And among its benefits was dependence on me." Byrd's reluctance to spend money on hiring professional staff members made him particularly vulnerable as he grew older and was less able to do the work himself. More and more research that should have been done, reports that should have been written, were not being done or written, and he knew it. And sometimes, in the most delicate way, Johnson began asking whether perhaps George Reedy or another of his Senate aides, Jerry Siegel, might prepare a draft, just some suggestions, really, for the senator's approval. In addition, as I have written, old men want to feel that the experience which has come with their years is valuable, that their advice is valuable, that they possess a sagacity that could be obtained only through experience, a sagacity that could be of use to young men if only young men would ask. Finding a word that evoked such feelings, Johnson used it with Byrd. He had a problem he didn't know how to solve, he would say. "Can I have a little bit of your wisdom?" He did a lot of thanking using that same word. "Thanks for that wisdom," he would tell Byrd. "I needed that wisdom." And older men like deference, and with powerful older men, Johnson took deference to extremes, and Harry Byrd was a very powerful man. Were men astonished when they saw Johnson bend over and kiss Sam Rayburn's bald head? With Byrd, it was not the head, but the hand over which he bent. Expressing gratitude for some favor Byrd had done for him, or sometimes merely to show affection, he would take one of the old senator's hands in both of his, raise it to his lips, and kiss it. In the opinion of some of Lyndon Johnson's Senate colleagues, Byrd's hand was not the only part of his body on which Johnson bestowed affection. With the Harry Byrds of the world, he was so submissive and so condescending you couldn't believe it, George Smathers would say. I've seen him kiss Harry Byrd's ass until it was disgusting. Senator, how about so-and-so? Can't we do this for you? After Johnson became the Democratic leader, he was not just Byrd's young friend, but his reliable ally. No appointment was ever made to a vacancy on the Finance Committee without Byrd's approval. Any bill, major or private, in which Byrd was interested was moved quickly to the head of the Senate calendar. As Byrd passed the age of 70 and moved well beyond it, and his stamina, although none of his mental acuity, began to fade, Johnson would, in the most tactful, considerate way, arrange with Byrd to have Louisiana's Long, an effective floor tactician and, as Senator Byrd trusted, manage some finance bills on the Senate floor, constantly checking in with the chairman, of course. Whatever the reasons for Harry Byrd's affection for Lyndon Johnson, one may have been his ill-concealed disappointment in his own son, Harry Flood Byrd, Jr., the affection was deep. Ordinarily not a man to tolerate being kept waiting, sometimes visiting Johnson in the hospital after Johnson's heart attack, he would find two visitors, the limit the doctors allowed at a time, already in his room, and others waiting on a bench in the corridor. Joining them on the bench, he would sit uncomplainingly, his dented Panama hat on his knee, waiting for his turn to be admitted. "Give Lyndon my best. Tell him the Senate is not the same without him," he wrote Lady Byrd. When Johnson was trying to decide whether to run for president in 1956, Byrd pleaded with him to declare his candidacy. All he had to do was say yes, the Virginian had told him, and he would never have to think about Virginia again. Its delegates would be solid for him until the end. By the later years of Lyndon Johnson's time as leader, it had become known around the Senate that Johnson could occasionally, not often, but sometimes, do what no one else could do, move the immovable Harry Byrd. Before one vote, on a measure about which Byrd did not have strong feelings, but on which he would ordinarily have voted no, Johnson confided to a Senate aide that he might persuade him to abstain instead. "Harry Byrd is a man of principle," he said. "I can't ask Harry to do anything against his principles, but I can ask Harry Byrd, and he might oblige me to stay away during the vote." Reading the Byrd text, however, Johnson had found one point very clear: the unshakable, immovable solidity of Byrd's fiscal conservatism, of his belief in the importance, for America and the world, of the balanced budget and an end to deficit spending. For the Virginian, there was a line, firm and hard, at which personal feelings, even paternal fondness, ended, and it was the line at which feelings collided with philosophy and issues based on that philosophy. Nothing, not even Lyndon Johnson, could soften in the slightest Byrd's unyielding opposition to government spending and government debt. Johnson knew that Byrd's references to a $100 billion budget were not offhand, casual remarks, that to the Finance Committee chairman, a budget over that figure would symbolize the launching of government spending into a new, unprecedented sphere. Under $100 billion, Johnson immediately understood, wasn't something Byrd was suggesting. It was something on which he was, in his bland, soft-spoken Southern way, insisting. Johnson had also realized that Byrd was saying something else as well. When the chairman had told Smathers that he wanted to see and prove for himself that the budget was under $100 billion, those words had not been chosen casually either. He had meant see and prove. He wanted to see the budget in writing. He wanted to be able to read it and have congressional staff experts analyze it to ensure that the budget was truly under $100 billion. That figure hadn't been lowered to that amount by some accounting or governmental gimmick. Johnson understood other aspects of the situation as well. For years, Harry Byrd had been trying to insist that government hold down spending without much success. Now, however, for the first time, he had a bargaining chip, the tax bill, to force it to hold spending down, at least to a level he considered acceptable. And he was using that chip. What he was saying, even if no one in the Kennedy administration seemed to have understood what he was saying, was that until he got a budget of under $100 billion from the president, got it in writing and had it analyzed in detail for himself, he was not going to release the president's tax bill from his committee. And Johnson knew if Byrd didn't release the tax bill, there wasn't going to be a tax bill. Talking with Johnson on the phone about the tax cut and budget, Robert Anderson, who during his years as Treasury Secretary had often dealt with both men, told Johnson that the best hope of breaking the impasse might lie in Byrd's affection for him. "Harry Byrd always voted with the Republicans until you became the leader of the Democrats," he said, "and you could bring him to us once in a while, and finally, on every crucial vote, you had him, and you can get him again." Overstated though that analysis might be, only on rare occasions had Johnson won Byrd's support on the significant fiscal bill, it contained a germ of truth. He had indeed obtained Byrd's support on several occasions when doing so had seemed impossible. That, however, it always required a personal plea. No intermediary would do. He had always had to go to Byrd in person. He was reluctant to request a meeting with Byrd now because making the request would weaken his negotiating position. He hoped the senator would make the first call, he told Anderson on November 29th. It would look a lot better if he was seeking the appointment. He asked Anderson to suggest to Byrd that he call, and when that didn't work on December 3rd, he asked Mansfield, explaining, "I don't want to be asking him." But no call came. Johnson had no choice. You couldn't go around Harry Byrd. Telephoning the senator on December 4th, Johnson asked him to come to lunch, saying, "Harry, why don't you come down here and see me tomorrow? I want to get some of your wisdom." Hanging up the phone, Byrd turned to Neil McNeil of Time magazine, who was sitting in his office, and said, "You know what that means. He wants to work on me a little bit." But McNeil recalls, as Byrd said that, his eyes were twinkling and there was a fond note in his voice. Planning went into that visit. Every courtesy was observed. Every gesture extended that would make Byrd of the Byrds of Virginia feel that respect was being paid to his power, and to the power of the Senate that he represented. The White House limousine waiting for him at the steps of the Senate office building went without saying, but there was also a tour of the White House conducted by the president himself, of the cabinet room, the swimming pool, even what Byrd called the little room where he gets his rub, and then the Oval Office, and beyond it the small office where they were to have lunch, with a menu selected by Johnson, potato soup, a Byrd favorite, and a salad. Byrd was the first person who had ever dined with him there, the new president said. The only other person in the small office was Jack Valenti, and thanks to his accounts, the lunch has previously been depicted as an unadulterated triumph for Johnson. By its conclusion, Johnson had gotten a commitment out of Harry Byrd, Valenti has written in one of his many descriptions of the meeting, reporting that when Byrd said, "I want to get it down to $100 billion, Johnson had asked, "Harry, if I do that, will the tax cut come out of committee?" And Byrd had replied, "In that case, maybe we can do some business." In reality, however, Byrd had not budged from his previous position on the budget during that lunch. Not only had he again insisted on the $100 billion limit, this very tough businessman had repeated his other conditions. Although Valenti doesn't mention this point, he had said that the tax bill might come out of committee, but only after he had been given the budget in writing, had seen it with his own eyes, and had had it analyzed. In addition, it was not just he who would have to see it in writing, he told Johnson during that December 5th luncheon. It would also have to be shown to his committee's ranking Republican, John J. Williams, the same Williams who was investigating Bobby Baker, a senator as adamantly opposed to government deficits as Byrd himself. No negotiating had been possible about those conditions. Byrd had been immovable. Johnson understood the ultimatum, as he was to explain to a caller the next day. "They, the Finance Committee, are going to hold this thing, the tax cut bill, until they get a look at our budget and then decide what to do about our tax bill." And he understood that he had no choice but to accept the conditions. If he didn't, there might, at the end of all the months of effort, be no tax bill at all. In some ways, nothing had been changed by the lunch. "They'd like to get it," the tax bill, behind civil rights and not pass it at all, he said. During that lunch, Byrd had received a commitment that he would get what he wanted, what he had been asking for months, a budget that would be under his magic figure and proof in writing that it would indeed be under that figure. If you don't mind, he said mildly to reporters after he got back to his office, I wish you'd point out that this is what I've been asking for all along. And to Johnson's request that he speed up the Finance Committee's public hearings and vote on all of the committee members' individual amendments before Congress's Christmas adjournment, so that when, in January, the budget was ready to be reviewed by him and Williams, the tax cut could come to the floor without further delay, Byrd told the reporters, I told the president you simply can't rush through a complex bill that runs more than 300 pages. Despite Valenti's depiction of the lunch as a victory for Johnson, the president emerged from it knowing as a certainty that there was no hope of having the tax cut bill pass before the end of the year and the current session of Congress. That, as George Smathers had told him in that first call about the congressional situation, he was simply not going to be able to do it. And he emerged from the lunch knowing something else. The budget had been cut to $101.5 or $102 billion through the use of gimmicks, in particular the promise of future supplemental appropriations, and the committee, Byrd's committee, knows how to spot the gimmicks and knew all about supplementals. By the time Byrd saw the budget, it had to be not merely below $100 billion, but far enough below $100 billion so that Byrd wouldn't feel that it had been reduced to that figure only by accounting tricks, wouldn't feel that the true figure was higher, and so that he would feel that federal spending for the year would still be below the magic figure, even after the inevitable supplementals had been added later. Nonetheless, hedged about by conditions though it was, a commitment had been made. If the conditions were met, we can do some business. And of at least equal importance, there had been a renewal of old ties. Cutting the budget to $101.5 or $102 billion hadn't really been all that difficult, but a lot more cutting was going to be necessary. The big hand grabbed the receiver. Kermit, get in here and bring your meat cleaver, Lyndon Johnson said. At dinners at the Elms now, there would be senators and congressmen, Lady Byrd Johnson was to write in her diary, and the current among the men was the tax bill, over and over. He had to get that tax cut, Jack Valenti says. So many of the things Lyndon Johnson wanted to accomplish, so many of the subjects Valenti had listed on his notepad during Johnson's monologue in the Elms that first night, depended on the increased tax revenues that would be generated by an expanding economy. Without them, it would be very difficult to do the things he wanted to do. It was his general feeling that everything he wanted to do would be hinged to the tax cut. After dinner, Lady Byrd wrote, he went back to his office and his telephone. I worked as hard on that budget as I have ever worked on anything, Lyndon Johnson was to say in his memoir, The Vantage Point. The budget determines how many unemployed men and women are going to be trained, how many hungry school children are going to be fed, how many poor people are going to be housed, how our entire population is going to be protected against a possible enemy attack. Day after day I went over that budget. I studied every line, nearly every page, until I was dreaming about the budget at night. Kermit Gordon seemed to be in his office every evening, Valenti says. Then they would call in the department heads, one at a time, and work on them. In memos to cabinet members and agency heads, Johnson, in Gordon's words, made abundantly clear his decision to tighten management and hold down employment in the federal government, and said he would personally review every request that would lead to an increase in a department's budget. In discussing with Gordon the budget director's meetings with cabinet members, his tone was even tougher. Is anyone going up on you? He would demand. For those department heads who, like Fowler, Rusk, and most of all McNamara, were cooperative, Johnson had a friendly voice. He's the only guy that's really trying to help me, Johnson said of McNamara in one call to Anderson, and he is trying to help. On December 7th, the Defense Secretary announced a series of steps that would lower his department's budget by an additional $1.5 billion. For those who weren't, there was a different voice, even for those Kennedy cabinet members whom he had thus far been handling with kid gloves. The gloves had to come off now. The tax cut had to go through, and that meant the budget had to come down. To convince the country and conservatives in Congress that he was doing everything possible to economize, Johnson wanted a symbolic achievement, to be able to announce that the total number of federal employees under the new budget would be lower than under the old one. But although a number of departments were reducing their payrolls, some were resisting, including the Department of Agriculture. The soft voice Johnson had been using with Walter Heller, and through Heller with Secretary of Agriculture Freeman, had evidently misled Freeman, who, despite the fact that Heller had given him Johnson's message to quit lobbying for increased expenditures, had continued doing so, sending Johnson a stream of memos arguing for a substantial increase in the Agriculture Department budget. "Obviously, he knows I've been doing a bit of agitating," Freeman wrote in his diary, "but according to Walter, this does not seem to irritate him." The magnitude of that misconception should have become clear to him when, on December 11th, he finally had an audience with Johnson in the Oval Office. He had expected, Freeman was to recall, a philosophical discussion with the new president about the overall goals of agricultural policy as laid out in his latest memo. Johnson told him he hadn't even bothered to read the memo, reminding Freeman that he had told him that he wanted him to deal personally with senators who were agitating for larger appropriations for various farm programs and keep them off my back. He said that Freeman hadn't been doing that, and he wanted him to start. He had told Freeman that he had to get along better with Capitol Hill, to spend more time socializing with senators and representatives, and Freeman wasn't doing that. "You go up there as I told you to do originally and live with these people," he said. And when Freeman tried to tell him how hard he was working to cut the agriculture budget, there was, the secretary says, a minor explosion. Suddenly, the president was standing very close to him, towering over him, and a long forefinger was jabbing at his chest. "You've got about the biggest increase in personnel of anyone in the entire government," the president said. "We've got to get that budget down." Evidently, however, the misconception still hadn't been cleared up. Freeman wrote another memo apologizing for having made perhaps a little more noise than anyone else about the budget, but saying that there was no alternative if agriculture is going to get its day in court. His vigorous management improvement program had drastically reduced the number of additional new personnel he was asking for, he said, but the number was nonetheless still 3,500. This time, he didn't even get an audience. "Orville Freeman's got a memo here," Johnson told Gordon over the phone. "He's got plenty of time to write memos." He read Gordon a few lines from the memo. "Mr. President, your comments about the number of employees and increases in the Department of Agriculture concern me deeply. My concern does not represent personal sensitivity." "Ha, ha, ha," Johnson said, in a voice that had no humor in it at all. He told Gordon to draft a reply for his signature. "To take this memo and not be unjust, but be just as close to being unjust as you can. Say, yes, you've given me seven reasons why you can't keep this thing down, but nevertheless, we're going to keep it down." He didn't want any more discussions with Freeman, he said, and he didn't want any more memos. He told Gordon to draft a reply that will get him away from writing memos, which take up my time, and cost us extra money, and see if he can't do some saving. "Let's cut down on some of these employees," Johnson said. "I know the difference between adding 3,500 and subtracting 3,500. Tell him to go back and work a little harder." By December 17th, despite a substantial reduction that Freeman, having evidently worked harder, had made in agriculture, and reductions in other departments, the number of federal employees projected under the new budget was still 7,000 greater than under the old, and 5,000 of the seven were in the post office department. Citing a sharp increase in the volume of mail the post office was handling, and opposition from the powerful postal unions to any cuts in the department's budget that would reduce the number of projected jobs, Postmaster General John Granowski had resisted any cuts at all in his proposed budget. When, on December 23rd, Johnson asked Kermit Gordon if Granowski had agreed on a budget compromise, Gordon said, "We haven't agreed on anything, not yet." "General," Lyndon Johnson said to Granowski when he had him on the phone, "he needed a compromise. And they, the Budget Bureau, just said that if you'd give us a Christmas present and work day and night, you could squeeze that down. Now don't you think you can?" The inflection of the question was pleasant, but when Granowski's answer was not an assent, the inflection hardened. "You've got 5,000 of the 7,000, Johnson told him. "We're trying to say we've got less employees next year than we had this year." "Defense has cut its number," he said. "State has cut its number. Interior has cut it. Agriculture has cut it. I've just got to have some real pruning and some real cooperation. You think about it." There were ways in which the number could be increased later, after the budget had passed, Johnson said. "I wouldn't mind going up in December, after we get the election behind us, and giving you a little supplemental appropriation," he said. "That possibility had to be kept secret for now," he said. "You've got to understand, there's some bookkeeping here and accounting, and we can't say that. But if you could just squeeze it out and say you're going to get by on less than you had last year, even though the volume's way up, it would just help us, because you've got 5,000 of those 7,000 jobs." Granowski continued to mention the strength of the postal unions and the necessity, if cuts were made, of cutting back postal services. Johnson mentioned opposing arguments. "People are wondering about these extra employees," the president said. "They might start wondering about the department's efficiency," he hinted. "A postal service was a monopoly," he said, "and anybody that can't operate a monopoly at a profit, by God, we've got some serious problems. If you give me a monopoly, I'll operate it at a profit. I'll guarantee you that." He had a list of the various departments before him. "Every department," Lyndon Johnson repeated, "and of the 7,000 increase, 5,000 of them are in postal." Granowski tried to make a joke of it. "I've got them all, huh?" he said with a little laugh. "No," Lyndon Johnson said without a laugh. "You've got 5,000 of them, though." The possibility that the press and Congress might get hold of those figures had sunk in. 5,000 out of 7, right?" Granowski said. "And I don't think you want to be explaining that," Johnson said. 10 days later, Granowski announced that the Post Office Department had found it would be able to operate for another year at the current personnel level, so the 5,000 extra jobs would no longer be needed. The budget was coming down. Although Harry Byrd had set tough conditions, he had said that if they were met, business could be done. The tax cut bill could come out of committee, and it was turning out Lyndon Johnson had again done with him what no one else could do. While Byrd still wasn't agreeing to end the committee's hearings on the original bill so that hearings could begin on the proposed amendments, now, when he gave a date by which those hearings on the bill might end, December 10th, he appeared to mean it, and indeed they did end on that date. The atmosphere in the Finance Committee offices had changed. After a conversation with Finance Committee Chief Clerk Elizabeth B. Springer, Mike Manatos told Larry O'Brien, "If I am any judge of Mrs. Springer's feelings, she reflects a much more positive attitude about Senator Byrd's desire to cooperate. Obviously, the president's discussion with Senator Byrd has been most helpful." Then came the committee members' 30 amendments. Byrd didn't want them all disposed of, because if, when he saw the budget, it wasn't below $100 billion, he wanted to be able to continue to hold the bill in the Finance Committee and not release it to the Senate floor, and an easy way of accomplishing that was simply to say that the committee was still dealing with amendments. The chairman's handling on December 11th of the first amendment, one that had been introduced by Russell Long on behalf of his state's oil oligarchy, was a case study in Senate procedure, that is, Senate delay. First, there was the question of whether, since the hearing was an executive session, a stenotypist should be present to record the proceedings. A simple question, but Byrd let discussion about it drag on for an hour and a half. Then one of the committee members asked a question about some unexplored aspect of the effect the amendment would have on the net amount collected through income tax, a technical question that had to be answered by the Treasury Department. Treasury officials had thought they had prepared for every question, but this one caught them by surprise. It could most easily be explained by graphs, they said, and it was decided that graphs should be prepared. The graphs couldn't be ready until the next day, so Byrd adjourned the hearings for this day. Some of Johnson's cabinet members sometimes seemed to be working against him. The amendment wouldn't have received such serious consideration had it not been for a letter from Treasury supporting it. "I thought you had an agreement that you'd be against every amendment," Johnson reminded Treasury's Dillon on December 12th. "Well, we're against practically everyone," Dillon said. Long had insisted that Treasury support his. That was the price for his working with the Kennedy administration to get the bill passed. If this amendment was passed, other senators would be encouraged to press for adoption of their own amendments, Johnson explained. "You'll have 30 more of them if you start amending it." The following week would be the week before the Christmas recess. Senators would begin leaving for home. "I'm afraid you won't have a quorum next week," Johnson said. When the Senate reconvened in January 1964, there would still be many amendments left to dispose of. And even if Byrd was agreeable to disposing of them, that job wasn't going to be easy. It was going to be a 9-to-8 thing every time in the 17-member committee. Johnson explained Byrd's tactics to Dillon. When Byrd had received Dillon's letter, he knew it would delay things, but the committee, Byrd, said, "Hell, we don't care about delay. That's what we're in business for, is to delay things." And sometime in 1964, the Civil Rights Bill was going to emerge from the House and go directly to the Senate floor. If that happened, and you don't have your tax bill, you will have to wait until after the civil rights fight, until after the civil rights filibuster, he reminded the Treasury Secretary. Dillon had to make more of an effort, Johnson told him. Every one of the committee's 9 Democratic members had to show up for every meeting so that there would be a quorum, and they had to vote against every amendment to prevent any further delays. "You've got to get them all in there and get them organized and say, 'God almighty, fellows, we can't stand this. We can't have this follow civil rights. You're going to ruin us on our fiscal program.'" Exactly what he had feared would happen was happening. "I'm terribly distressed," he told Dillon. "I'm just distressed that it's going to get behind civil rights. If it does, it's goodnight grace." Johnson was misquoting the words "goodnight Gracie" that George Burns spoke to signal the end to each week's episode of the popular George Burns and Gracie Allen show. The next day, December 13th, there was another conversation between Johnson and Byrd. President though Johnson may have been now, he pleaded with Byrd, pleaded as if Byrd was not a foe but an ally. He was working to give Harry what he wanted on the budget, he told him. "I'm working in my budget every night. I was up till 1 o'clock last night. And I'm going to get you a budget I think you'll be proud of. I'm going to help you with the budget." Pleaded as if Byrd was an old ally and an old friend who, like him, might see all their hard work go down the drain. He found a line that worked. "If the tax reduction bill was passed as part of the arrangement with the budget," he told the old senator, "you can tell your grandchildren you were the senator who finally got a president to cut his budget." And having found the perfect line, he used it. Unless the bill had Harry Byrd's help, he told him, the bill might not pass. "What we want to do, Senator, is to try to get those amendments voted on before we go home, or at least as many of them as we can," he said. "What I'm afraid of is, if the civil rights bill arrived on the Senate floor first, if your tax bill," note the pronoun, "got behind it, why, all of our work would have been done in vain. So I'm just so anxious to run it, the hearings, morning, afternoon, and night, and try to get these amendments voted on." They had both been working so hard, he said. "You help me get that bill out. I know you're against it, but you're a good chairman, and you help them vote. You're tired of this talking yourself." And he began to make him an ally. Finally, during that December 13th call, began to get him, as Bob Anderson had predicted he would get him, persuading Byrd to subordinate at least to a degree his desire to stall the tax cut bill, to subordinate it to this opportunity to realize the grand aim of his public life, to slow down government's headlong rush along the path of fiscal profligacy, on which a budget over the magic figure would have been yet another step, to pass a budget that might signal a beginning at last of a turn toward governmental prudence and economy. Russell Long watched it happen. He had been unable to move the tax cut bill, he was to recall. I couldn't move the bill out of committee. Then, he says, Johnson worked with Byrd, promised to cut spending, and Harry changed his attitude. Up until then, he wasn't going to permit the bill to pass. But now, when Lyndon Johnson told Harry Byrd that he knew Byrd was tired of this talking and wanted his committee to send the tax bill to the floor, Byrd replied with a single word, right. From Harry Byrd, a single word was enough. The amendments started to move faster. Chapter 20. The Johnsons in Johnson City. I'd move my children on through the line and get them down in the storm cellar before I'd make my attack on civil rights, Johnson had told Sorensen in June. The tax cut bill wasn't down in the cellar yet, wasn't safely locked and key, but it was, at last, moving through the line, and he had a commitment from Harry Byrd to keep it moving. And the time remaining during which Congress could pass a Civil Rights Act was a lot shorter now than it had been in June. The moment for the attack had come. Strong as was Lyndon Johnson's compassion for the poor, particularly poor people of color, his deep, genuine desire to help them had always been subordinated to his ambition. Whenever they had been in conflict, it had been compassion that went to the wall. When they had both been pointing in the same direction, however, when the compassion had been unleashed from ambition's check rein, then not only Lyndon Johnson, but the cause of social justice in America had moved forward under the direction of this master at transmuting sympathy into governmental action. Now, in the days following the assassination, they were pointing in the same direction again. With every week, that became more obvious. As one of Larry O'Brien's aides, Henry Wilson, was to put it to O'Brien, I think civil rights is the total touchpoint for the press. If we passed it relatively intact, plus the tax bill and nothing else, we'd be credited with having a good year. And if we don't, no matter what else was passed, we'll be credited with having a bad year. The highest hurdle in the path of President Kennedy's civil rights bill would be the Senate. Decade after decade, civil rights bills that had passed the House had died there, and the reports Johnson was getting from the Senate indicated that nothing had changed. They tell me they've, the South, got enough votes to never allow cloture. They say they can never get the 70 votes we need, he told Andrew Hatcher. The bill hadn't even reached the Senate yet, hadn't even reached the floor of the House, where a vote would be required to send it to the Senate. It was still trapped in Judge Smith's House Rules Committee. And if Smith was allowed to piddle along and get it into February, and then maybe they won't get it out of the House until March, the Civil Rights Bill would be as dead in 1964 as it had been in 1963. When, in the first days after the assassination, Johnson started exploring the civil rights situation, there was seemingly very little that could be done. A vote within the Rules Committee could be held to have a majority of its 15 members overrule its chairman and set a date for hearings. While 10 of Rules's members were Democrats, however, 3 of them, in addition to Smith, were from the South, so there would be at most only 6 Democratic votes to overrule. At least 2 Republican votes would be needed to provide a majority. And every time the possibility of using Republicans to strip a committee chairman of his authority had been raised with the House Republican leader Charles Halleck and his deputies, they had recoiled at the very hint of overturning the body's traditional procedures. There was only one other possibility. The only thing we can do, Speaker McCormick told Johnson, a single remaining lever that might move the immovable judge. To obtain the signatures of a majority of the 435 House members, 218 in other words, on a discharge petition, a resolution to discharge the Rules Committee from its control of the bill and send it to the floor. Although this was also, as the New York Times put it, a procedure rarely invoked because it offends traditionalists to whom time-hallowed house rules are sacred. The procedure had, in fact, not only been employed against Smith before, in 1960, but employed successfully. As the number of signatures on that petition had slowly mounted, Smith, fearing what the Times called the indignity of being relieved of responsibility for the bill, had given in. When the number reached 209, he had allowed his committee to release that year's civil rights bill to the floor. During the week following President Kennedy's assassination, a rebellious liberal congressman, a constant irritant to party leaders McCormick and Albert, Richard Bolling of Missouri, had introduced a discharge resolution, but when Johnson began looking into the civil rights logjam, a memo from O'Brien on November 29th told him that the discharge lever had been inserted into it too late to break the bill out of rules before Congress adjourned. Given signature of the petition by a majority of the members of the House even immediately, the memo said, it still would not be technically possible to put the bill on the floor before December 23rd, by which date Congress would probably already have adjourned. House rules required a waiting period of 7 business days after a petition acquired the 218 signatures, and then can be called up for a vote only on a second or a fourth Monday of a month. The 7-day waiting requirement made a vote on December's second Monday, December 9th, impossible, and getting a majority to sign was unlikely anyway. The 209 votes had been obtained in 1960 only because that petition had Sam Rayburn behind it. There was no Rayburn now, and without him, there was no one to persuade the House to bend its normal procedures. Of the 257 Democrats in the House, 90 were from the South, and others from the adjoining border states were allied with the South. The maximum number of Democratic signatures that could be hoped for was about 160. To reach 218, about 60 Republican signatures would be needed. The enthusiasm for civil rights expressed by many Republicans, particularly the GOP's large block of Midwestern conservatives, was more on their lips than in their hearts. Committed though they were to vote for the bill itself, they would welcome any excuse, such as the inviolability of sacred house procedures, to avoid doing so. In addition, seeing the civil rights issue as one that split and spotlit the split in the Democratic Party, Republicans didn't want it settled. Reaffirming his opposition to the petition on the Thanksgiving weekend Sunday television talk shows, Halleck said that during his 28 years in the House, "I've never signed one yet." In a Republican caucus the following day, he, other GOP leaders, and even a key architect of the House civil rights bill, William M. McCulloch of Ohio, assailed the very concept of bringing a bill to the floor without the customary rule from the Rules Committee. As Henry Wilson reported, Republicans have no intention whatever of pushing Smith into early action. And without Republican votes, without any realistic chance of passing the discharge petition, our last threat to Smith will have been removed, and he could hold out forever, as Wilson gloomily put it in one of his memos to O'Brien. But Lyndon Johnson was worked up now, revved up, all worked up and emotional, and work all day and all night and sacrifice and say, let's do this because it's right. Those commentators who have questioned the sincerity of Lyndon Johnson's commitment to civil rights, questioning that persists to this day, simply haven't paid sufficient attention to the words that had burst out of him when he had been telling the governors why a civil rights bill should be passed. So that we can say to the Mexican in California, or the Negro in Mississippi, or the Oriental on the West Coast, or the Johnsons in Johnson City, that we are going to treat you all equally and fairly. He had lumped them all together, Mexicans, Negroes, Orientals, and Johnsons, which meant that, in his own heart at least, he was one of them, one of the poor, one of the scorned, one of the dispossessed of the earth, one of the Johnsons in Johnson City. What was the description he had given on other occasions of the work he had done in his boyhood and young manhood? Nigger work. Had he earned a fair wage for it? I always ordered the egg sandwich, and I always wanted the ham and egg. Nor was it financial factors alone that accounted for his empathy for the poor, for people of color, for the identification he felt with them. Respect was involved, too. Respect denied because of prejudice. He had understood those kids in Catulla, the disappointment in their eyes, the quizzical expression on their faces. Why don't people like me? Why do they hate me because I am brown? They had been denied respect for a reason, the color of their skin, over which they had no control. So had he. For him, the reason was his family, his father. Never amount to anything, too much like Sam. He had swore then and there that if I ever had the power to help those kids, I was going to do it. And now he was to say, I'll let you in on a secret.